Hello and welcome to the Buzzcast. I'm John Adams.
And I'm Andrew James.
And we're here to talk about all things photographic, put the world to rights in general, and hopefully give you some tips and tricks to try when you're out with your camera. In this episode, we look at the best accessories for sharp shots if you're going on safari with long lenses, and discuss the art of substitute metering. We also have another motivational tip you can use right now in PhotoVator. But before we get onto all of that, what I've got, Andrew, is you started shooting film in the 80s or 90s. What do you think shooting film has brought you in this digital age?
Oh, wow. In terms of how it's shaped my photography, do you mean?
Yes. Yeah, do you still go back to anything? Have you kind of pressed a reset button with the advent of digital? I know we're going back, you know, 20 years probably to the advent of digital, but did that press a reset button for you, or do you still sort of hark back to those early days of film in terms of the discipline, the way you shoot?
Yes, there are. I mean, I think coming from a film background was a really good grounding in learning the principles and the basics of photography, because it was expensive not only to buy, but also to develop. So that meant that after a few completely messed up rolls of film, you soon learned to use your camera in a way that was more economical, shall we say. So exposure improved hugely and relatively quickly. But that said, I don't hanker back to shooting with film. I still actually got a bag of all sorts of film somewhere in the garage, which I just cannot bring myself to throw away for some reason. I've got some film cameras, and I did a few years ago take a film camera with me on a trip to Cuba and shot some film on it then, but just decided that when I got back and looked at the quality of the pictures on this old Russian camera that I'd bought from eBay, that was pretty much a waste of time. And anyway, so I'm not one of these people that looks back and thinks with rose-tinted glasses at the world of film, thinking it was always much better back then, because it wasn't actually. I think digital's going to be a massive boon to photographers in general. It's allowed us to do all sorts of kinds of photography that we never would have, and the learning curve with digital can be much faster because you get instant results. But I do think the discipline of having shot film has been very useful to shaping, I guess, the whatever you want to call me in terms of my photography today. I've just, you know, it's certainly helped in that. I think it helps me to teach people about photography, people who don't have that that heritage with film in the same way.
Yeah, it gives a great grounding in the basics, doesn't it, of what's really important to photography, which is kind of light and time, I guess, and perhaps ISO in that sense. So that's part of light, really.
Yeah, I suppose so. And I think one of the dangers of digital photography, particularly with newcomers, and even with people who have been doing it a long time, is the fact that we just shoot so many frames because there's no cost in wastage. So we just rely on that kind of idea of, well, one of them will be all right, won't it?
I guess when looking back to the film, when you had 36 to that was your role, and that would cost you £5 or £6 to dev.
Yeah, well, even less if you were shooting medium format as well, of course. So, you know, you wanted to be really careful with that because you didn't have many frames. So yeah, I think there's a danger that, yeah, we're a bit sort of almost take it for granted, the fact that we can see the image on the back, that we can look at a histogram, and that we get it, you know, 95% right. This is why in one of the past podcasts I said about taping the back of your digital SLR up
to turn it into the film discipline.
Yeah, just to discipline yourself a little bit more. There are certain things. I mean, if you think about some kind of hangovers or kind of heritage of film in terms of processing, you know, it's quite fun to play around and get some of those old filmic looks on your digital
because images. You've got past experience of them, so you know how to recreate, yeah. Or you know what you're looking for. Yeah,
yeah, I guess.
No, so. I wonder, because it was the other day I was rooting around in the loft trying to find. It was actually some old flash gear I wanted to use for a setup, and I found this box and it was full of my old film cameras. There are various Nikons going through the ages up there, and I sort of toyed with the idea of I should get a few rolls of film and put these into practice, you know, to kind of see if they still work and see what the images look
just
like.
Just come in my garage. You can help yourself.
Yeah, but I then thought, well, why would I do that? And I didn't, because I remember there was sort of almost a conscious point in my photography where I felt I'm leaving film behind now. And that was the advent, particularly of, it was actually the Coolpix 990 from Nikon, which was only a 3-megapixel camera. But I thought, now I don't need to use film anymore. So even with a 3-meg camera, the quality was sort of good enough to think about leaving film behind. And at that point, I mean, up to that point, rather, I was scanning film. I'd shoot my own black and white or colour trannies. And then they'd be scanned. I had a film scanner, so I'd do 4K scans from those. And that was my sort of, you know, I suppose a hybrid film and digital approach.
Yeah, I think we all went through that period, didn't we?
You know, but I thought at the time, I don't need this anymore. I wouldn't go back to it. And you know, after looking mournfully at these cameras in the loft, I still thought the same thing. It was lovely to have done it, but it's gone. And I think there is kind of a reset button, and you don't, there's no benefit to going back to film. It's a bit like if you think of a road atlas that everyone used to have in their cars.
Hmm.
And when you've got a sat nav, you dispense with a road atlas. You don't really need it anymore. It's a thing that's gone.
But I think there's an element here where there are people who are still wedded to film because they feel it's something more real about it. There's something kind of a little bit more organic in a way. I'm sort of BS words, I'm afraid that, but you know, and I know that there's also something in terms of if you want to be artsy, you know, doing a kind of a throwback using film and producing something like that, it involves something a little bit more elongated and more involved than just pressing a shutter button quickly and seeing the results instantly.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, you have to immerse yourself in film. When you've only got 36 and then you have to dev them up. I mean, I used to shoot, my favourite black and white stock was Fuji Neopan 1600. I wasn't sort of a Tri-X or an FP4 or HP5 bloke. I was on Neopan 1600.
I'd always said that about you, funny enough, John. Yeah.
But and the only reason I think for that was it's because I got lucky with it. I had quite a lot of published work taken using that black and white stock that I was devving myself and scanning. So I stuck with that because for some reason it did me some favours, I think.
If there was anything that I would want to do film wise these days, it would be black and white, because I sort of miss the you know, going into a dark room and actually devving my own prints. There's something really
nice. That's
where
the magic photography was, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I can still remember seeing the first print, you know, in the development tray just coming through
as it emerges,
like being oh my god, because you don't have that same wow moment, I don't think, in digital in quite the same way anyway. So it's that is something that I sort of miss on one hand, but on the other hand, when I think back to how much I must have spent on paper getting when I'm messing up prints and all the rest of it, I mean, I should think personally I kept Ilford in business for about 10 years.
Just the stuff you're throwing away
exactly.
That didn't work.
You know, because it takes a long time to get that. But I do sometimes think that would be nice to do again.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I suppose, the magic moment of photography. Have I got it right? Have I got the right settings? Have I used the enlarger correctly? Have I masked off the right? Have I done my dodging and burning correctly? And then when the print emerges in the dev tray, that's like the wow.
Yeah.
And then there's always that snatching out to fix it.
Yeah.
So you don't overcook it.
Yeah, no, totally. That is the sort of the nostalgia of film. I think for me is black and white developing. I mean, the moment when I decided I was going to be completely digital has just come back to me. I was in Africa. I'd taken a digital, my first digital SLR, which was the Canon, was it D60 or 60D? I can't remember which way around they put it. They had one the other way around eventually. Anyway, still got it somewhere. Had it converted to infrared in the end. And I took that and a whole bag of film, and I basically didn't shoot any film.
I just carried it.
I did. And then I remember being in the hotel in Nairobi, and I had this massive bag of film. I'll be honest with you, folks, that the film was given to us by Fuji and Kodak, because we worked on the magazines back then, so we didn't have to buy it. So what I'm going to tell you now is based on the fact that I had a slight privilege in this area. But I thought, am I going to carry all this blinking film back with me, or am I just going to dump it? And I actually put it in the bin in a hotel in Nairobi, and then went home without it, because I hadn't used it. And I'm pretty sure from that point on I shot very, very little film after then. It was all digital because it was just such an amazingly simple way of creating what we wanted to create.
So that was a very physical turning point, which involved a bin in Africa. So,
well, yeah, and for me actually it was quite interesting, because at the time I was the editor on Practical Photography, and we were at that cusp of, you know, where film was still important and had been important to the readers for many, many years. And there was this new thing coming along. John, you were on digital photo anyway by that point, so you were scanning your film and doing all sorts of kind of wicked things to it in processing.
Yeah,
already
I was
on Photoshop.
Already on the dark side by then.
Exactly, and so I came back knowing from that point that I really had to start manoeuvring the readers not away from film, but into the new era, because digital was going to just swamp film. There was no doubt in my mind after that trip to Africa that was going to happen. It wasn't what everybody thought. I can remember certain people in the industry back then saying digital burn, it'll die out.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah, we're not going to mention names, but
no.
But people who were working in similar places to us. And I was just like, well, no, that's not the case. And so we started to change Practical Photography, which had been the film photographer's magazine for a long time, into something that embraced digital. And I can tell you, I got lots of complaints. I had letters from, you know, disgusted of Dover and furious of
Folkestone. Frog,
thank you. I was going to say Froggate, but I have no idea where Froggate is. Anyway.
Angelic of alliteration.
Yeah. No, I did. Saying, you know, digital, it's, you can't, you know, why are you doing digital on Practical Photography? It's absolutely wrong, blah, all this stuff, all this nonsense. And I replied to every single one of them. And my reply was, if I don't embrace digital with Practical Photography, that magazine will not exist in 5 years' time. It was as simple as that, because I could see the writing was on the wall for it. But what I wanted to do, and then, as I still do now, which is, explain that actually it doesn't matter whether you're really shooting on film or digital. Those principles that we talked about are exactly the same. If you, there are some variances in terms of how you need to approach and how you shoot stuff. But the real basics of photography, which is the exposure at the end of the day, aperture, shutter speed, and ISO, are exactly the same. There is no difference in the terms of how you think about those three things, that exposure triangle, whether you're shooting digital or whether you're shooting film.
No, I'd agree. They are the same to use, or it's just one of them doesn't really cost you anything and gives you a very fast learning curve because of the immediate results, the Polaroid back that's built into a digital camera where you have that screen. Whereas the film approach, I mean, there literally were Polaroid backs you would fit onto medium format cameras. And even on some of the professional 35mm cameras, you'd have a tiny Polaroid back that would give you a 35mm frame as an image. And that's what people would stand around. Clients would look around and think, yeah, that's the kind of thing we want, yes. And that was to check contrast ratios. Of course, all of that stuff's gone and is no longer necessary. But I don't think there's any disadvantage to starting in the digital plane. You don't have to hark back to film to know your photography.
No, not at all.
There's no real advantage to having had a background in film anymore. But I was interested to talk about it because there's a perception, I think, with a lot of people, a lot of the older folk who've been in photography for, you know, 30, 40 years, there's this idea that, oh, they started with film, so they're real photographers. But I don't think there's any real truth in that.
No, I don't think it matters really. I mean, I just like, you know, I say the reasons I gave at the start, which is it just made you a bit more disciplined, to, you know, when you were learning with film, that's all. But equally, I've met and worked with and, you know, or seen people who, you know, who have grown up with digital, never touch film, who are amazing photographers and would have been amazing photographers had digital never come along. If, and I think this is one point I wanted to make, if they'd ever taken it up, because actually what's happened with digital, I think, is it's opened up photography to a whole world of people who never would have taken it up before.
That
I think
democratization.
Totally. You know, if you look back at you're talking about the film photographers 30, 40 years, I bet you they probably male. You know, they're a certain, perhaps possibly a certain, yeah, a certain type of person. And you don't see that so much with digital photography, because, you know, it's equally a male or female environment, and actually some, you know, I think female photographers are often far more creative in their thinking than male photographers are, and I think even when you look at how photography on your phone has changed stuff. So these may not be people that are going to pick up a DSLR or a compact system camera ever in their lives, but they're being incredibly creative with their photography in terms of their compositional work or their just how they want to express themselves. And that for me is photography in as much as what we do as photography.
And with your average phone nowadays or smartphone outputting a 12 megapixel result, I mean, I talked about the Coolpix 990, which was kind of my first foray into digital or digital capture, and that was a 3 megapixel camera. Now a phone has got a 12 megapixel camera. Quality is no longer an issue in that digital stake. So it's it's interesting how it's changed.
I do think one of the this is probably a topic for another one of these conversations, so perhaps we shouldn't go on about it too long, but I think one of the issues with digital photography coupled with digital processing is that often images are almost too perfect. I've actually written an article about this on PhotoBuzz. This search for perfection, and you see it quite a lot if you go on some of the, again, not going to name websites, but certain websites that are sort of gallery websites. You see these absolutely beautifully perfect images where everything has been done to such a point that, you know, you see every bit of detail. Actually, but they lack atmosphere. There's something that's slightly missing from
the
it.
The clinical, slightly plastic approach to perfection. Yeah.
Whereas you didn't necessarily get that with always with film. I mean, you know, if you're shooting black and white or any blinking high ISO film colour stuff, you know, you'd have grain the size of golf balls, and, you know, but it was part of that substance of that picture. The color rendition of Fuji Velvia or whatever you want to talk about, you know, all those things were part and parcel of those things. And also, we didn't have that ability back then to sort of really to zoom right in to every pixel, because there weren't pixels, but you know what I mean, to zoom right in on those images to look with such a microscope that we could sort of basically polish every little tiny bit of it. We didn't do that.
Well, the grain would get in the way of that. That's why you didn't scan beyond 4000 dpi, because the grain became the component you were scanning. You were just scanning the granular structure and not the actual content of the image.
Exactly.
But I know what you mean about the perfection thing, because it's a bit like the difference between a house, a loved house that has sort of people living in it, and a show home that's kind of clinical and sterile and doesn't really give you anything. Or a car with no dents. I mean, it hasn't been driven.
Well, yes, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that would argue that case, but I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that argue the case against everything that we've said, actually, which would be fair enough.
And that's what we'd like you to do, actually. If you think there's a benefit to having started on film or a disadvantage to having started on film, then do post your comments, because we'd be really keen to hear your views as well. Because I think we've kind of made our minds up that we both did it, but it doesn't matter. But then we're talking from a point of experience where we did it it and we've decided post hoc that it doesn't matter. But maybe you have a different view to that. So do give us your comments, because we really want to hear what you say, not what we say. Right, Andrew, it's time now for Q&A, or if we want it long form, questions and answers. Got a question here that might be a good one for you, actually. I'm going on safari this year and will be using my 400mm lens, but with baggage restrictions, I don't think I'll have room to take a tripod. How will I get sharp shots in low light conditions?
Okay, good question there. And actually quite an interesting question, because a lot of people assume when they're going, particularly on their first safari, is they're always going to have beautiful sunshine and lots of light because they're in Africa. And quite often I've been there when the light has been quite difficult. So there's a couple of should we unwrap this question? First of all, let's talk about the tripod situation. I tend to take a tripod with me and I'll wrap it in bubble wrap. And clothing and all the rest of it, and put it in my luggage that's going into the hold.
Yeah.
So that's how I get around the baggage restrictions if I'm going to take a decent size one. You can get some nice little travel tripods as well, but you've got to remember, if you're using a 400mm lens, you don't want to use it on a light travel tripod.
No, you're just going to snap it, aren't you?
Exactly. But of course, the point is here is that if you're on safari, you're generally going to be photographing from in a vehicle. So actually, the tripod's pretty much useless.
You won't even be taking it out with you on your exactly. Day trips out. You'll be in a Land Rover, won't you?
Totally. So, you know, forget about the tripod from that point of view, unless you're going to go on somewhere where you're going to be able to shoot shoot from a standing position. Unlikely, I would have thought. Or you're going to be able to shoot from a standing position and do some landscapes. Then for wildlife stuff, the tripod doesn't really matter so much. So you might just want to leave that at home. The next thing you need to think about here is the fact that if you are shooting in low light, you need to put your ISO level up much higher. People tend to get a little bit nervous about going, you know, to 400 even, sometimes even 800. But I kind of go by a simple rule is the ISO I need is the ISO that will give me a fast enough shutter speed for the shot I'm going to take.
So, because people worry a lot about noise, about sort of getting reduced image quality by using high ISOs, but you're saying ignore that. Better to get a good image with some noise than no image at all or a blurry image.
Yes, of course. Now, I know I'm using a 1DX Mark II, so the noise control within that is better than a mid-level or even a starter DSLR. But however your camera deals with noise, getting a sharp, noisy image is better than getting an image that isn't sharp but is noise-free, because that's just a delete image, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I remember, you know, years and years ago, the formative years of my photography, grain, but this was back in the film days, was quite an attractive thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't an issue. You would actually choose particular film stock to get that grainy effect. So it's not something to worry about too much.
No, it isn't. And I think the whole noise issues, and maybe something we can look at again in a different buzzcast, I think, because I could talk all day about it, which would be really boring. The last thing I want to say is that actually, if you're working from a vehicle, you can get, there's all sorts of different, sometimes quite expensive gadgets you can get, clamps and bits and pieces to use. But the simplest way of getting a steady shot, if you have got lower light and you've pushed it to, I don't know, ISO 3200 and you're nervous about going a bit further, you've got a static sitting lion. The best shutter speed you can get is, I don't know, 250th of a second. You can get a sharp shot with that if you're using a beanbag.
Yeah, because when you're shooting on safari, often the Land Rover's got roof rails and you can lean your camera lens or support your camera lens on the roof rails. All you need is something that will absorb some of the shock and actually give you a steady mounting platform. And a beanbag is the ideal solution.
Well, beanbag is perfect. Yeah, not just the rails, but over the, you know, if you've got the window's going to be open, you've got it over the door thing there, which is why I like the double beanbags, because you've got a nice sort of weights either side, if you sense from the beanbag thing itself, and it sits there really, really nicely. In a lot of cases, and you want to check this when you're going, the safari company that you're using or the place you're going to may well supply beanbags, which is ideal. Check how big they are, because if they're really little kind of naff ones for somebody with a tiny little lens just to, you know, rest a camera on, then they're good for you with your 400mm lens. You can buy ones. Wildlife Watching Supplies do really good beanbags, especially those double ones. But of course, if you're going to take those full...
That's going to weigh a ton, isn't it? That's your baggage allowance almost gone.
Exactly. What I have done in the past, although I accept it's not always going to be possible, depending on where you're going, but you could take it empty and then you could maybe go to find somewhere you can buy some just beans, you know, haricot beans or whatever, and actually fill it up. And I have done that, but I, you know, maybe that's not something that you can do. But or you could, if you've got the, again, got the bag, and you can get two smaller bean bags that maybe the safari company is supplying stuffed into it, you've still got a little bit more bulk to be able to rest that lens on. So that's what I suggest, is a bean bag. That's simple.
That's the ideal solution. Shooting from vehicles, bean bags are brilliant. And they're really fast to use as well.
They are indeed. Absolutely fast. Okay, so moving on. John, I've got a question here I think you can help with. Now, well, it actually names you. So the question we've been sent is, I was interested in the comments John made about metering in one of our earlier Buzzcasts. Remember those?
Yeah, yeah.
You talked about the three metering modes in camera. But how do I use my spot meter if I don't have a mid-tone in the scene?
Ah, metering, yes. Well, what the spot meter does, let's get some basic definitions down. A spot meter records or measures from a very small angle within, generally within the centre of frame, or in fact over one of the AF points. So it measures like a 2 degree area of the scene and will take an accurate meter reading from there.
Yeah.
And the information it gives you will be based on that area being a mid-tone, which is generally measured as 18% reflectance. So if it reflects, I know, if it reflects 18% of the light falling from it, you'll get kind of 50% grey if you pointed it at grey.
I've nodded off now. Come on.
I know, it does get a bit technical. But this is how you get an accurate exposure. So it means that anything bright in the scene will look bright, anything dark in the scene will look dark, your shadows and your highlights will be accurately recorded. So that's kind of what a spot meter does. It just measures a tiny part of the scene and gives you a reliable, accurate exposure of that scene.
So what if there's no mid-tone then? Because that's the specific question.
Well, that's the question. Now we know what a spot meter does. We then think, so you shoot, let's say you're shooting a wildlife scene and you want to get your colours accurate, you want to get your exposure accurate. All you have to do then is point at something of average reflectance. So you point at your grey card in the scene, which of course, if you're in a Land Rover on safari, you can't just knock out.
With your beanbag.
Yeah, with your beanbag, you can't just sort of hop over the side, run over to the lions.
But you can.
Get one of them to hold a grey card and then move back while you take your exposure reading. You can't do this kind of thing. So you can either try and spot mid-tones within a scene, which is an acquired art that takes some time, or you can do what's called a substitute metering method from something else in the scene. If you find something white, for example, you could meter from that as though it were a mid-tone and then add exposure compensation to it. So we know that white, pure white, is about 2.5 to 3 stops brighter than a mid-tone. So if you meter from, let's say, a white sheet of paper, keeping on the sort of in the pseudo-reality version, you meter from a white sheet of paper or a patch of snow or anything white in the scene, and then you add about 2.5 stops of exposure compensation, you'll be using that just like a grey card and getting an accurate spot meter reading to give you an accurate exposure. If you meter from something in the scene that's black and then subtract about 2.5 stops of exposure compensation, you're doing the same thing. So substitute metering is a method where you pick something in the scene and then add or subtract exposure value from that subject to give you an accurate exposure reading. So that's all it is. It's just using other items in the scene that are perhaps brighter than a mid-tone or darker than a mid-tone and either sort of adding or subtracting exposure compensation according to how bright or how dark it is.
But a lot of the time, of course, you're not going to have necessarily something pure white or something pure black, or necessarily, as we said, a mid-tone. So how do you know how much you need to subtract or add to the exposure compensation to get that right? Because there is a bit of guesswork or educated guesswork in here, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, experience is the great key for it. For example, if you look at nature's reds, I think I mentioned in one of the earlier Buzzcasts that nearly all nature's reds, think of a poppy, they will be a mid-tone. They'll be absolutely spot on. So you can just meter on those, add no compensation, and you should get an accurate exposure for the entire scene, provided, of course, your poppy or whatever is in the same light.
Yeah.
So if you pick something that's brighter than a mid-tone, grass, for example, is probably half a stop to one stop brighter than a mid-tone. Tarmac would be close to a mid-tone. So you kind of look around at things within the scene and you think to yourself, well, what is neutral? What is a mid-tone? Spot meter from that and you'll find you'll get an accurate exposure. You could actually spend, if you're a bit nerdy, you could have a fun afternoon going out trying to spot mid-tones. And then you substitute those midtones for things that are brighter or darker, meter from those and compensate accordingly. But that's the game of substitute metering. It used to be really critical if you're shooting on slide film. To have that kind of knowledge would have been quite important because you can't really blow your exposure on slide film. Nowadays, shooting raw, it doesn't matter nearly as much. And if I'm completely honest, I seldom use it. It's a fun exercise, but I seldom use it because I find that matrix metering or evaluative metering, multi-zone metering, is pretty accurate most of the time. And by the time I've taken a test shot, checked the screen, checked the histogram, I've done all I need to do in order to get an accurate exposure. And I don't need to go through that kind of, you know, that dance of finding mid-tones, spot metering, or finding brighter. It takes the same time just to take a test shot and see what you've got.
Yeah, of course, we got the histogram as well, which we're not going to talk about now because I think we've used up the time, but checking that histogram is still really quite useful.
Your histogram gives you an objective, you know, graphical measurement of the exposure value in the scene. So, yeah.
Yeah, and also with a lot of the cameras now, if particularly the, you know, the mirrorless stuff, what you see is what you get as well.
Yes, through the viewfinder, you've got the, yes, the screen check, and you can bring up your histogram as well in the viewfinder. So you have all the information at your disposal that you need to get really good accurate exposures. So a lot of these are more traditional or perhaps archaic metering methods aren't so necessary nowadays, and you don't need to know about them to be a good photographer.
What we're going to move on to now is that little thing that has possibly the worst jingle in the world ever created, because we created it in 3 seconds during the middle of the very first Buzzcast, I think.
I think I know where you're going here.
I'm talking about Photo Vater. So, John, you're going to give us a Photo Vater, aren't you?
Well, I think so. And one thing I'd like buzzers to do is think about light and think about how they can control light. And a great little exercise you can do is grab some Bako foil or tinfoil, get a roll of it, tear a couple of yards off, scrunch it up in a ball, put it in your camera bag. Leave that in your camera bag, because what you have there is a fantastic reflector that can be sculpted and molded to any shape you like and is brilliant, particularly if you're working on a small scale. Pop down to your local woods. Everyone's got some woods. A handful of trees is all you need for a woods. A little copse will be fine. Pop down there. Have a look around the ground. You'll find some textures. You'll find leaves. You may even find some fungi. But get down there. Perhaps take a bin liner as well to protect your clothing, because you may need to lie flat on the ground or lie on your back to shoot up at the tree canopy if necessary. But get down low. Get your tinfoil out, scrunch it into a ball, then open it out and flatten it out, and you can form that into a great reflector that can actually be far more useful than commercially available reflectors. Things like, you know, Lastolite reflectors that fold up, they're great, but with the tinfoil, you can actually bend that round corners, you can hold it against trees, you can sort of put it in amongst the roots of trees, mold it to shape, and by molding it, you're also molding the way it reflects light.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. I mean, obviously with a big purpose-made reflector, you've probably got a bit more power and you've got a bit more light that, you know, it'll find more light than a small reflector will, like the tinfoil reflector. But if you work it right, as you say, for a small scene, then you can have quite a bit of fun seeing what difference it makes by putting bouncing light back in.
The great thing to do if you've got room in your camera bag is take just a sheet of black card with you as well, something like that. Once you've got your reflector in place, and if you've molded it and you can see how the light's working, just hold the black card over it while you're looking through the viewfinder, and you'll see your reflector's power disappear, and you can sort of do quick A and B checks with and without the reflector to see how effective it is at providing some fill light. And it doesn't matter. The other thing, people think we've got to have a light source to reflect. No, you don't. If you've got an overcast day, which is actually an ideal day to shoot kind of woodland close-ups and things, it will reflect from all around. So it will still gather light. Even though the light is dull and perhaps very diffused, you will still be firing some light back because it will bounce from anywhere.
Yeah, it might be subtle, but it's still there,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah, it's going to be subtle, but that's what photography is. Your lighting is subtle. You don't want to, it's not like switching on headlights or switching them off. You need to just mold it, sculpt it, and sometimes using things sort of at half an angle, turning it slightly away so it just gives a hint of light in certain areas can make a big difference. So I'd certainly recommend that. Put a sheet of tinfoil in your bag and take it with you. And always remember you've got it there because you've got an instant reflector that can be used at any time.
Okay, sounds good. That was Photo Vater.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this Buzzcast. Leave your comments below and we'll be back very soon with another one. But for now, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from me.